Unless you want to speak about Donald Trump, because the last week's been pretty hectic.
I'm declaring in this podcast a Trump-free zone. I think even our friends in America would appreciate that. They can listen to our podcast for an hour and a half without just kind of forget what's happening in the horrible, hideous world of 2017. We thought 2016 was a bad year. Yeah.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. My name is Ian Mond. My co-host is the lovely Kirsten McDermott. And this is episode 58, recorded on the 29th of January, 2017.
Oh, date checks now.
Why not? At least because it's the first of the new year. So.
Well, I go to the trouble of putting it on the sheet, so we might as well say it.
So I know it's a bit late, but Happy New Year.
Oh, thank you very much.
Because I don't think I ever said it to you in SMS or Facebook Messenger format.
No, probably not, which means it didn't happen.
And so. Because you live so far away, this is the first time I've seen your face in 2 months.
Yeah, because we didn't do the December one. So yeah. Correct. How's your year been so far? We can move on from that question. I don't want to answer it either.
I was just in Hillsville for a weekend.
I know, holiday. I saw that on Facebook.
That was really nice.
Looked like fun.
That's where I finished the second book.
Did you pat a kangaroo?
We got close. Oh. I didn't actually pat
the kangaroo
at the sanctuary. Well, I don't
know.
They
tend to come over and try to actually
mob you. They were extremely, they were so lazy.
Oh, hot day, right?
Yeah, it was a hot day. And they couldn't be fucked, the kangaroos. Neither could most of the animals. The koalas were just, well, they're nocturnal.
Koalas tend to just sit around and do nothing for most of the day.
Did you know?
Okay, here we go.
That eucalyptus leaves have lots of protein in them, and mostly fiber.
Yes.
But it takes so much for the koalas to digest it that they're left with very little energy, which is why they don't move much. You did not know that. Do not pretend you knew that.
It's
no.
Like, I did. It's like celery. In fact, it's better than celery. Celery has a negative caloric properties.
As like, in it takes more to digest.
It takes more energy for your body to digest than the actual pittance of calories you get out of eating celery.
Well, eucalyptus leaves right up there. And yet they're so fat, koalas. I don't get it.
They're big boned.
I shouldn't body shame. Which? Good segue.
Oh, ha. It was actually a good segue. I'll pay that.
Thank you. So we're doing two books.
Doing two books.
The first of which is Body by Asa Nonami.
Yes.
My son, who now studies Japanese at school, actually pronounced it correctly. He just seemed to know the right pronunciation of Asa's name, but I'm not very – well, I assume it's Asa.
From what I'm not completely au fait with Japanese, but from what I've been told, there's not a lot of in English we emphasize a lot of syllables within words, where in Japan there's not a lot of emphasis on syllables. So you wouldn't say nonami. It's nonami. So
it's that's why my exactly how he said it. Yeah, except I want to, express nonami like that.
Exactly, because we're English and we're used to putting, we're not English, but we speak English. And in English, there is a lot of emphasis on syllables.
And we're
words.
Australian. And in Australian, we also emphasise symbols. Syllables, we do.
We also drop them. So,
so nami.
Nami. That's the nami.
That's all right, so we made fun of the author's name and we're 5 minutes into it.
I think we've made fun of Australians.
That's one way of reading this conversation. So that's our first book, Body. Now, you chose it.
I did choose it. Oh, God. This is going to be a long podcast. I'm very tired. I chose this book, and it was not the book I actually expected it to be. Not that I thought I'd chose a different book, but I just feel like that could have sounded like, oh, but this one arrived in the mail, and I thought, fuck it, I'll read it anyway. I chose it because it was on a list of interesting horror genre books. I can't remember if it was a list of female authors or if it was just interesting horror books that kind of went under the radar about a year or so ago, and I thought, I should read that. It wasn't quite...
horror.
It wasn't quite horror. Not in the sense that we think of horror. And I've been doing a lot of thinking about the horror as a genre this year because I'm judging the Aurealis Awards for horror novel, which I won't talk about other than to say that's made me think a lot about the genre and what the genre does and what it looks like and how it can infiltrate and so on.
Because you don't believe that horror has to just have... must have supernatural elements.
Oh, God, no. Because
there isn't, well, one of these stories...
One of the stories definitely has. Yes. One of the stories is quite a good fit for what you'd call a speculative genre, and the others are absolutely not. The others are not speculative at all.
They're straight. But straight stories can be horror, so...
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's whole subgenres in horror that have no supernatural elements. You've got various serial killer type genres.
Except they're called thrillers.
No, not when they're told from the point of the serial killer. Then they usually land squarely in horror. Like it's an interesting thing when you have, a story about a serial killer, and this is not like absolutely black and white, but generally speaking, if it's told from the point of the investigators or the layperson who's found a serial killer or whatever that is, that, tends to get thrown into thriller categories, and there's like a million you can name. But if it's firmly grounded in the point of the serial killer, as for example American Psycho, that would sit more squarely in the horror genre. I think it's about where the focus is. So is the focus on, the people trying to discover and stop and catch the killer, in which case that's more thrillery, or is the emphasis on, like, dwelling in the mind of someone
who
lives like that? I think the victim would also fall, depending, again, how it's treated, quite squarely into the horror genre, because that, again, the emphasis is on that horror. So it depends, I think, on the emphasis of the book and not just where the story lies, but the tone of the book and the effect it's creating in the reader. And I think having horrific things in a book doesn't necessarily make it part of the horror genre, because if you did that, there'd be almost no books that weren't in horror.
Correct.
So, I mean, I forget who said it. I'm not even going to try to remember who said it. But there is a critic, or perhaps it was a writer critic, who did point out that of all of the genres, horror is unique in that it is one that centres around an emotional state as opposed to a setting or a plot line that encompasses a genre. And it is. I mean, romance would come close, I think, not to being horror, but to being a genre that centres a lot around an emotional state. So when you're looking at what books do and do not fall into a genre, you are looking at the tone of the book and the aim of the book and the type of engagement it wants to have with its reader.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's a slippery fish because horror does get its tentacles into everything at some point. And it is quite interesting to think about what makes a book horror and what doesn't.
But
it's kind of like art, really. It's like that thing, like, well, I know it when I see it. And horror, to some extent, is that, and because of that, it will change for different readers. So perhaps the person who made this list, has a more expansive.
Well, there's
view
a
of
there's
horror.
A visceral aspect.
Yes,
it's very visceral.
Yep.
It is about the body.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a collection.
But see, I wouldn't necessarily call this body horror. Then that's what I thought it was. I thought it was a collection of body horror, which I'm quite interested in.
Well, it's five novelettes. They're longer than short stories.
Yeah.
So they're not connected in any way, shape, or form. This book was originally...
You mean by characters or something?
Yeah.
Because they're connected by theme.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Sorry. Yeah. Yes. That.
But in terms of, there's no recurring characters or continuing plot.
God, I thought you were going to get me like you got me last time with the...
No. Yes.
The book came out, well, it's debatable on Goodreads. It was 1999 or 2000.
Because we are reading a translation. It was originally published in Japanese, and we are reading an English translation, which...
Badly typographed English translation. Did you notice a lot of the...
Yeah.
I don't normally notice those things. But
it wasn't... shall we say, proofread with less care than it probably deserved.
So you notice that, yeah.
I do notice those things. I'm not an amazing proofreader, but I do tend to notice, yeah.
But I won't knock it too much because it's translating.
I did have a couple of issues with the actual translation, but we'll get to that. Anyway, finish your overview.
Thank you. Came out in 2012, translated by Takami Nieda, or Nieda, again. It's all those, yeah, anyway. So always worth mentioning who the translator is because they deserve as much credit as the author. Well, that's a debatable thing, but you get what I'm saying.
They deserve credit as much as the author does.
Yes, yes.
English, you just put words in different orders and they mean a different thing, even though they're the same words.
Amazing. So five stories, all linked to the body in some way.
Yeah.
And each one titled by a body part.
Yep.
So we've got navel. Well, blood is not a body part, but it's...
Yes, it is.
It's a part of the body.
Yeah. It's not... Okay, it's not,
it's not a
limb or something, but...
it's okay.
It's part of the body.
And I suppose, blood and whirl are features.
Well, that refers to... Okay, I'll give you whirl as in cowlick in your hair as a...
It's a feature.
But blood's not a feature. I think blood is pretty essential too. Having a body, a live body, that is.
True. And buttocks and jaw are the last two.
And so each of the those parts referenced, a central concern or obsession of the character in each of the stories.
Yeah, they're not necessarily the focus. So navel, for example, is the starting point of a story about plastic surgery. blood is, again, something that sort of drops in and drops...
Yeah, it comes up later, actually.
Yeah, quite late
in the story. I was wondering what the blood was about. Well, but all of the, it's a really clever... And I did like the book a lot. And all all of the parts that are mentioned, they've got this dual meaning, though. So the surface meaning of the particular part of the body that is referenced in that story and that... might be, the theme is around. But there's this secondary meaning to all of them.
Like, is there?
So in Navel, which is the first book, which is about...
body modification.
Plastic surgery and wanting to, quite disturbingly from what I could glean, have a more Western-style body for the Japanese mother and her two daughters who are in the story. Because all of the physical descriptions all seem to skew towards...
But is that the translation, though? Because I noticed also that 911 is the emergency number.
This was some of the... There was quite a few Americanisms in the translation, and the 911 is obviously a dynamic translation. They don't call 911 in Japan for emergency services, so this is the translator translating for an American audience... what the character is saying when the character says, "Oh, quick, call 911." And there are other bits where the translations were quite American. And
I got no impression that the body modification was a Westernized body. I mean, maybe the navel slit.
When they're talking about shaping noses and having pale white skin and lifting the flaps of the eyes so that the eyes are more open.
You think so? Okay.
I think it's skewing not towards a Japanese woman wanting to look like a Western woman, but it's a more subtle influence about, pale white skin being the preferred skin color and wide open eyes being preferred more than heavily lidded eyes and all of that stuff that skews away from a particular facial shape or body type and skews more towards another. It is very, it's very subtle. They don't come out and say, "We want to look like a white Western woman." But it's definitely, although I'm sure there was a reference to European features being more desirable. I think one of the doctors actually explicitly says that.
Yeah, in Navel.
Right. So it's a definite, it's quite uncomfortable to read.
And
So it begins with one of her younger daughters. She's got two daughters, and
this is the mother. The story's told through.
Yes, the point of view character is the mother. None of them are first person narratives; they're all third person, but they all have a single point of view character.
Yep.
And so the youngest girl wants to get her navel reshaped because it's round and open, and apparently having a slitted navel is...
Is that a Western thing?
I don't think the navel is. But, you know, among the teenage girls and all her friends who want to wear crop tops and midriff tops, having a big round navel is not good. You want a nice little discreet little slit.
Is that for real?
Oh, that's for real.
Because these were written 15 years ago, so I don't know.
Navel surgery is for real. Yeah, absolutely. No, but and people who are outies get them reshaped to be innies because apparently having an outie navel is not good. I mean, no, like...
So that's still a common thing today?
Yes, plastic surgery is really common.
I know plastic surgery is common.
But plastic surgery is really common for tiny little things. In fact, that's really popular because that's often cheaper, right? It's cheaper to go in and get, you know, a small thing done than it is to actually go and do something where you need general anaesthetic and a couple of days in surgery. So all of these very minor little things, none of which, as in this, this is really well done in this story, none of which ultimately satisfy the recipient.
Well,
and they need to get more and more and more done because that's...
Yeah,
you know.
So the mother is against it, against her daughter doing it because she knows that the father, who's got very strong conservative views, will be horrified, but ultimately she allows it to occur.
Yeah, because it's a little thing, right?
It's a little thing, which won't be noticed by the father.
And there's a student discount. And yeah. All these horrible... Like, it's a... Yeah, but no, so...
And then the mother is then lured...
Yes, to get her crow's feet fixed and then to get her chin fixed and then to get her nose reshaped.
And because she's got a trust fund or she's got her own money salted away, she can pay for it herself.
Yeah, it's not a trust fund. It's money she's been saving from housekeeping.
Yeah.
But the money she would like, it's really sad because the money that she was saving, like when the, like it's not very explicit. All these stories are quite subtle. Nanami has a really deft hand with creating character psychology without actually spilling everything out onto the page and giving you this psychological report. But it seemed like the money she was putting away was for a not yet crystallized idea of her future and what she might do with herself and her life. And you know, she might go and do a course in something and she might do this thing over here.
Because her kids are quite old now.
Yeah, her daughters are both, you know, one of her daughters already moved out of home and the other one is... a late teenager. So and in the end she ends up spending all the money to kind of fix what doesn't need to be fixed about
herself.
And
ostensibly for her husband to notice her.
And for her husband to notice. Well, and then when he doesn't, for other people to notice her.
Which they
like it's
do.
All about
but
outward,
that's the thing.
Yeah.
They do notice her. She you know, there's comments about how young she looks and da 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 da.
Yeah.
But her husband never ever notice
her. Her husband's kind of a dick.
He is a dick, but that's the key though, because because if it was just external people noticing, she would have stopped. She would have said, well, I've done what I had to do. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
But she keeps going. So you realise she needs that validation from her husband.
It is a husband, but it's also everything, because even when she gives up on the husband, she's still going back. No, and it's the doctors who keep saying, well, if you just had this done, you'd look another 5 years younger.
Yeah, but for her husband.
Yeah.
It's all tied back to him.
Yeah, it is all about looking desirous. But there is a shift when she starts saying, well, if he doesn't care, I'll find another man. Like, it is all about looking desirous for a male person. And she likes the fact that her female friends notice things too. But as you say, that's not her focus. It's quite, it's really sad. It's actually a really, really sad
But what does this
story.
Say about, I mean, look, plastic surgery is important for all sorts of reasons. But all plastic surgery is surgical,
invasive?
No, not non-invasive. Plastic surgery you don't actually need, as distinct
elective?
From yes.
There we go.
Thank you. Elective,
as opposed to treating
burn victims
scars
and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
that's right. So elective plastic surgery. This story, in a Japanese context, but frankly, it's worldwide. It does sort of. Just the way that vanity is so easy to tap into vanity.
But also insecurity, because that's what underlies the whole thing.
Yeah,
it's not she's not and neither are her daughters. None of these women and girls are confident people. They're not confident about themselves. And so there is a vanity, but I think more importantly, is underlying this need to look better, look younger, be more desirous, is this deep insecurity. Because from the beginning, like the very beginning of the book, from the first page or two, there's manifest all of this insecurity she has about her husband and her husband loving her and desiring her. And even before she even thinks about herself getting plastic surgery, that she's deeply insecure about her marriage.
And that's the theme of every story.
Yeah.
Insecurity and vanity. Each one.
I don't know about vanity.
Well, okay, insecurity.
Insecurity.
All right.
Insecurity and fear.
Of not being loved, of not being respected, of not being part of the in crowd.
Yeah.
Each of these stories taps into that well in different ways. That's what's quite lovely about this book, that it isn't the same theme just regurgitated. It's done differently in each story. And as you said, the psychology of the characters isn't just exposited to you.
No.
You don't get this three-page start where Joe blogs and da-da-da-da was da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Really never loved by her husband and da-da-da-da. It's just all subtly done. It's very transparent prose, which I think is a good mark to both the author and the translator. Because if that's obviously in the original text, it's well brought out by the translator.
Yeah.
So, and you're right, it's from a psychological perspective, it's something that we just understand without having to have it explained in depth.
There's never any clunky exposition about.
But it's not horror
about how a character is feeling or why they're feeling it. It's just you get. She does a lot of showing, not telling.
Correct.
But it's not horror
at all. The closest you get to horror is Buttocks.
Yeah, but even that, I think that's
which is the one, the anorexic story.
Yeah, yeah, and that's. I mean, that's the horror of a young girl who, falls into eating disorder and hideous sort of self-image because she can't. She wants to fit in. She doesn't fit in. She's been moved to a new school.
Well, she's been sent to Tokyo without really wanting to go. She never asked to go to Tokyo.
To a new school in Tokyo.
Her parents have put all this pressure on her saying...
Yeah. Her parents kind of got her into the school where her grades really weren't quite there. So, but her parents paid a bit of money, so she got in. So then there's pressure for her to keep up her grades, or
she lost all her friends at home.
Yeah, and she's also like in her old school, she was sort of the queen bee and the bully.
Yeah.
So she's lost that, and she's moved to this new school where, and she loses that before she even leaves her old school. Right, because her friends find out that she applied to this other school, which she hadn't told them about because she didn't think it wasn't a big deal to her and she didn't think she'd get in anyway, so she didn't even mention it. But then she did get in and it's kind of announced at assembly or in science class. A science teacher kind of announces that, hey, congratulations, you got into this school. Well done, you're the first student to get into a high school. So because her friends then get really angry and also a bit jealous because it's a really prestigious school in Tokyo, whereas this is in a regional area.
Yep.
It's not it's not a big city that this story begins in. So her friends are angry with her for not telling them, and then jealous, and so she loses her status while she's still at her old school. So she knows what that feels like. And then, of course, she goes to the new school and she knows no one and has no friends and has no status, and she gets obsessed. And there's a remark made by one of the girls about the fact that she has a really big ass, and that focuses her need to fit in, whereas she's been a bit wavering before then about how she might fit in. And this kind of focuses, oh, okay, well, if I can just make my ass smaller. And it is really – it's a very detailed and disturbing picture of this descent into body dysmorphia, which is what she ends up having, and she gets dangerously skeletally thin.
And again,
doesn't want to eat.
No one really noticing until it's too late.
Yeah, well, yeah, because
her parents are.
She doesn't live at home. She doesn't see her parents more than a couple times a year, so she's just talking on the phone. And you know, there's also the thing made where when she does go home and they notice she's lost some weight. When it's still sort of a healthy weight range, I guess, it's considered normal. Of course she's losing weight. She's on a diet. She's a young girl. Of course that's what young girls do. So it's normalized. There is no hint of danger signs until it's too late. Because, of course, a young teenage girl is going to want to lose weight and be on a diet. Like, what's wrong with that? That's healthy, right? That's what teenage girls do. There's nothing wrong about it or different or anything to be concerned about. But what's really interesting about that story is that it twins her, like her obsession with losing weight and not eating is, it's not just, it's sparked off by the comment the other girl in her dormitory makes, but it's also underlined by, I guess she has hemorrhoids or maybe an anal fissure or something like that, because she has
she has problems having bowel
movements. Yeah. And they're painful and there's blood. And because she has been fairly closeted, and you get the impression this is not an appropriate her body is not an appropriate topic of conversation amongst her family. That she doesn't know, she has no idea what it is. She has no idea what it is, and she doesn't go to see a doctor.
So the body dysmorphia, you're right, is sparked because it suits her not to eat.
It suits her not to eat because if she doesn't eat, she doesn't have a bowel movement. And her entire goal becomes not just to look thinner and to fit in and to look like a stylish young lady from Tokyo, but also based on a very real physical discomfort. So she thinks if she doesn't have to have a bowel movement anymore, then that doesn't hurt and that will get fixed too. And her mind kind of arrows down to this. When you step back, it's so ridiculous. Like a human being cannot stop defecating unless they're dead, which she finds out much to her horror, because no matter how much she doesn't eat, she still shits and it's still painful. And in fact, that would actually make it worse because you're not getting lubrication. Anyway, I'm not going into that. But
yeah, but the story sort of does.
Yeah, but so she's making her situation worse without knowing. She doesn't even consider going to a doctor. Like it's like her, yeah.
This is a plot hole point of view, but just in
no, but she doesn't even think of it. She doesn't even think that she almost normalizes the malfunctioning of her body. She almost comes to think this is a normal way her body works. So then she has to find a way to fix it because there'd be nothing a doctor could do. Not that she says this, but this is the impression you get. Like it's not something she can medically fix. This is just what her body does. And so she just has to stop eating and shitting and it'll all be fine. And as another benefit, then she'll be thin and stylish and attractive
and popular.
And
you don't think that's horror?
I think this story comes quite close. But it's so grounded in... I guess it's just so grounded in the.
I suppose it becomes maybe dismissive of body dysmorphia, anorexia. If you just say, "Well, it's a horror story,"
that's what I mean.
Because it is a mental illness.
Because otherwise, isn't any memoir about having body dysmorphia or something like? Isn't any of that then horror? And it's not. It's clearly not. This is something which is looking at, you know, human psychology and our relationship with our bodies. And I don't think that necessarily fits into the horror genre, but, you know, it is very disturbing and uncomfortable fiction. So I don't know. It's really hard. It's a fascinating book. I liked it a lot, and I'm interested in looking up more of Nonomi's work. And I'm also interested in seeing if there are different translators who work with her and what the style might look like, you know.
So you
like
get back to this translation point.
No, it's just I find translation fascinating because, as you say, like the translator is a crucially important part of the book. And you can give a book to 10 different translators and you will get 10 different versions of it. Not that the story or the plot or anything of that will change, but the styles will be slightly different and the tones may be slightly different. So it is fascinating.
I am interested to know what you thought of the sexual fetish story, Blood.
Oh, that was quite a disturbing story. But again, it's like, and this is where you get back to all of the titles of these stories having these mirror meanings. So with Navel, you've got the daughter who wants to get her navel fixed because she thinks it's ugly and it doesn't look like a navel should, scare quote, so therefore she wants it fixed. And but as the mother points out, the mother is one of the reasons she's initially resistant to it is not just because the father will disapprove, but because she looks at the navel is literally the place that she was connected to her daughter, and she's uncomfortable with having that change because then it won't be. And this story does, as it goes on, reshape the connection between the mother and her two daughters because of what's happening with all of the plastic surgery. That connection is reshaped and to some extent, in some ways, strengthen. There's almost a bonding through the plastic surgery, but then there's also this disconnect between the mother-daughter relationship, because their relationship becomes entirely focused on,
in the sense that she no longer looks like the mother that they
and you know, when her older daughter gets something done too, her older daughter no longer looks like her older daughter. So there's this disconnection, and
husband at no stage notices.
Because he doesn't care.
So what's the double handling? The twinning or theming or whatever in
with
blood.
Well, because there's so much.
Because the guy's turned on. Ultimately, finds out he's turned on by blood.
By the sight of you know, blood coming out of a cut or a wound or something. Whereas first he's pinching women.
He's rubbing himself against their ankles.
It's not their ankles. It's their knee. So he's lowering himself so he can press his knees into the back of their knees.
He then gets a knitting needle, secretes it into his clothing.
Yes.
And pricks women specifically.
Yes. Yeah.
Knowing that they are feeling pain, and that gets him.
And they might be bleeding under their clothes, and that he gets turned on by that. But the other side to that story is about family. And his mother and his son and his wife's family, and how there's that friction between his wife and his mother, and because the story begins with him having been arrested by the police for
groping.
He doesn't look at it as groping because he was merely pressing his knees against knees, but that meant he was also pressing his groin against buttocks. But that was incidental to him. He was just about the knees. But so it begins with that having happened and his wife taking their son and going to stay with her parents for a couple of weeks. And because of what's happened, his mother doesn't know. So his mother just thinks the wife has taken off with the, and how dare she? So there's this friction between the mother and the daughter. And I mean, the thing which starts the blood revelation is the needle that the mother, who is a seamstress, leaves on the ground and that the wife steps on and draws blood from her heel. And there's a big thing made about how the mother's usually extremely careful about leaving needles around.
Because she has a magnet that
so you think that maybe she left this one deliberately to, I mean, so all of, so yeah, family, yeah. Blood, family is such a big part of this story, and family connection and obligation and duty and friction between families that are joined.
What's interesting is that the fetish, I don't know, in another story, the fetish would become some sort of serial killer thing or it would get over exaggerated. It never feels over exaggerated.
No,
it always feels
it's
always very subtle.
It is.
And it's still bad. He's still violating people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Middle, but it's never over the top. It's a very subtle form of violation.
It never escalates to significant damage or mutilation or murder or anything like that, that a story like this could quite escalate.
But he can't handle the possibility of being shamed for doing this. And so
he doesn't actually care about the women he's hurting and terrifying. He just doesn't want to get caught again.
Correct. And so he puts – yeah, he convolutes these ways because his wife obviously knows, but she on his begging doesn't tell. Well, she –
I don't know that she knows about the knitting needle.
No, she doesn't. She doesn't. She only knows about the original thing. It's about him then trying to figure out how he can get, because he's sort of attracted to his wife sexually, but he finds But he finds that if she might bleed for him, that would definitely get him hard.
But you know, he does like the point is made several times that she's not his type. She doesn't have the knees for a start.
Yes,
she doesn't
correct.
Have her knees pretty are, soft.
They're knobbly
knees that he likes.
I think the word knobbly is used quite often.
So he can be sexually attracted to her, but she's not. He's not really. I think it's more.
But it's interesting how the fetish goes from. To an extent, I don't understand how knees gets connected to.
I don't think there is a. I was thought about that, and I thought, well, is it the. Like, because if you, like in the backs of your knees, you can have prominent blue veins, and maybe that's, but I think that's, I don't think there is a connection. I think he's had this one obsession and then bang, he stumbled upon this other one, which is even more powerful that it overshadows his original.
Yeah. And he just does say that the whole point is that it's instant gratification, but this intensity of a relationship without the need for all the dating and stuff. It's this momentary relationship that. To be fair, the other person doesn't know about that they're involved
that's what
in.
I mean. But he surrounds
he fantasizes
the object
that,
of his fetish in a fantasy.
Correct.
That these women are his girlfriends and his partners. And it's in this minute or two on a subway train, that he's selected a woman and either rubbed his knees against her or later on poked her with a knitting needle, in those couple of minutes he's created this entire fantasy about his relationship with this woman. Yeah, which is completely one-sided and completely non-consensual. And it's really disturbing. And he's not...
But never overtly violent.
Well, unless you count stabbing someone with a knitting needle.
Well...
Like, it's pretty violent. And it's psychologically violent. I mean, like, he is because there's, like, his mother talks about it. Like, this becomes a story. This,
yeah,
this
it person gets on the news.
Who's poking people with knitting needles. He is... terrorizing. Is it Tokyo this is set in, or
yeah,
is it?
I believe so, yeah.
I think it's Tokyo. But he's terrorizing the city, right? I mean, his mother even warns him. She says, "Oh, I know this person seems to be targeting women, but anyone could be a target, so you should be careful. I don't like you riding on the subway anymore." You know, like, it's not necessarily a major physical wounding, but the psychological fear and anxiety that anyone would have riding home on the subway now, especially if you're a young woman, is immense.
I just mean in the sort of gratuitous, gory...
Yeah, exactly. That's, as we said, it doesn't escalate to mutilation or murder or anything like that that a story could. But that kind of emphasises that what he's doing, like, it is... obviously, it is better than mutilating or killing someone, but it's still really bad. We don't need... Like, if this story had escalated into that... That would be then diminishing what he's actually doing.
Correct. There's an intimacy here that...
You know, the idea of that would be, well, this isn't so bad because look what he's done now. Like, the story stays on this thing and emphasises how
intimacy.
Bad this is.
It is intimacy for him. So, therefore, it's... he's not... He hasn't... It's intimacy without compliance, without consent.
Consent, yeah.
And without compliance. It's intimacy without consent. And
yeah,
it's,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And it stays on that. It's like its focus remains on that act, which doesn't have an immense physical repercussion. But then that's like...
Even with his wife, it's intimacy without consent.
Yeah. It is because he's trying to cause her to bleed. quote-unquote, accidentally.
But then he discovers at the end that doing it to himself is...
pretty good. So, fine, masturbate all you want to. Leave the women alone.
Look, there are two other stories, but we don't necessarily have to discuss... I mean, the last one is the one with the speculative content.
Yeah, it's so Whirl is about the guy who's losing his hair and
takes a revolutionary... a drug that's being tested for male pattern baldness... And, of course, he's...
Makes him infertile. Yes.
His dick goes limp. let's say it the way it is.
Makes him impotent, I meant to say.
His dick goes limp. And that's an interesting story only because... It's a number of reasons. Yeah, it is, but it's just this whole idea of should I marry her? She's not really beautiful, but she's a nice girl.
He's dating this girl that he doesn't actually care that much about.
Yeah.
Doesn't really like, but he's got the idea that he should get married at some point, but not before he's 30.
Yeah.
And she obviously really likes him and wants to get married. And he's kind of leaving, like they're seeing each other, they're having sex in hotels and all this sort of stuff. But it's quite clear he doesn't really care about her.
It's only when he starts losing his
hair. She's going to be his shelf girl that he will string along and keep interested and eventually marry when he's 30 and should get married. And then because he ends up not... She doesn't leave him because he starts losing his hair. He starts losing his hair and gets anxious about it and starts thinking, oh, well, no one will...
No. He starts losing his hair, gets anxious about it, takes the drug, can't get hard anymore, prides himself on the fact that that's something he does really well, even if he's not entirely attracted to the girl.
He's really good at sex.
So therefore he can't meet her anymore because she, as he points out, is quite aggressive sexually.
Yes.
And therefore he has to... It starts with the hair but ends with his dick. So he can't be in the same room with her because he knows that she'll want to... jump his bones and he can't get it up. Yeah,
but you've also missed that little key bit in the middle there. So like he starts losing his hair and that triggers his anxiety about then not being able to get other women.
Yes, correct.
So then he thinks, I better marry this one now then.
Yeah.
And then he's anxious about being impotent. He's like, oh, what am I going to do? I need to marry her because I won't be able to get a better one.
Correct.
Like he's such an awful person.
Terrible human being.
He's so awful in such a petty human way. And then, of course, because he's been avoiding her, because he's worried that he won't be able to get it up and therefore she'll leave him, which, FYI, I don't think she would have. She actually, bear in mind it's all filtered through him, but actually if you kind of try to read through the cracks, she sounds like a really nice person who genuinely loves him.
Yeah, and in a couple of stories, if people had just sat down and spoken it out.
And she wouldn't have cared about his hair loss. Correct. And she wouldn't have cared about his I mean, the impotence of it would have been a problem.
Because she makes a big thing about his hair and the whirls.
I know. But she's being nice, right? Like, yes, when you love someone and you're you talk about it. But it doesn't mean that if he lost his hair, she'd go, oh, you've got no hair, I'm going. Like, she seemed to me, from what the way he described her, even though he was really awful, to be a really lovely person who adored him and wanted to marry him because she loved him, not because, you know, he was high status or anything like that, which he's not. So the comeuppance is that because of all of this, she ends up feeling disconnected and she decides they should separate and it's not working. And then he's sad because, well, now he's lost her and he won't be able to get anyone.
And he's just received the phone call from the drug guy saying, you might want to stop taking those pills.
Yes, because he doesn't associate his impotence with the pills.
Well, no.
He thinks it might be, but he said no one else has had the side effect, therefore it's...
Because
it's,
no one else is willing to own up that the pills might...
So he thinks, oh, well, then it's me.
There's no communication.
Yeah.
No one wants to sit down and actually talk.
Well, this is like...
So much pride and so much avoidance of shame.
Yeah, and like the parts of the body that are talked about in this book are, you know, for the most part, they are things that we don't talk about, the intimate stuff. You know, it is embarrassing. Like in Western culture, like in our culture here in Australia, we don't talk about it. And I think there are exceptions, but I think it's a very common human thing not to want to talk about the intimate parts of our body and the intimate workings of our body. You know, we don't want to talk about our genitalia. We don't want to talk about if we have hemorrhoids. We don't want to talk about if we break an arm. If you break an arm, that's fine. Hey, I broke my arm. I did this stupid thing or I did this great thing. But I've got hemorrhoids. You never want to mention that, right? No. You never want to mention if you think your ass is too big. You don't want to mention if you have this fetish about blood. You don't want to mention if your hair's falling out if you're a guy. Or worse, if you're a woman, my God, that's like the worst thing I think that can happen to a woman is her hair falling out, as perceived by society, right? So all of these things, we don't want to talk about them. And as you say, that's anxiety and creates problems that if we could talk about this stuff might be resolved or might at least be lessened. Our anxiety would be lessened if we could say to our partner, hey, my hair's falling out, I'm really anxious, you won't love me. And they say, well, you're ridiculous, I love you, I don't care if you're bald as a bowling ball. But we don't want to talk about our anxieties. Because also there's this dual effect. We don't want to talk about the thing that's wrong or that we feel is wrong because the thing itself is embarrassing. But we're also embarrassed about being worried about it.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? Yeah. So it's like my hair's falling out. I feel anxious about that. And then I feel more anxious about being anxious about worried about my hair. So it's this doubling effect of anxiety, and this book deals with that really well.
Fantastically. I think the last story is the weakest.
Because it's a speculative story.
Well, probably because it is, because it's like, well, you don't figure out it's speculative until the end. But
no, I didn't actually see the end coming. Like, I didn't see, and we're not going to spoil it because these are short stories, and I think it's really nice.
It is a Fight Club-y sort of book, and about a guy who basically, he's been picked on. He's been fired from his jobs constantly. Mm. He's on the street, so he doesn't have he's got no money.
He's homeless.
He's homeless. And basically decides to take up boxing or fighting. It's not boxing, but it's fighting to get some sense. And takes it up so obsessively that people start to respect him, da-da-da-da-da, starts to fight in the ring.
I think it's actually – and look, I like Fight Club, both the book and the movie. I think they're doing interesting things. I think what this story is doing with that theme is a lot more subtle because he actually doesn't end up – fighting. He doesn't. He ends up boxing. He ends up bouting.
Yeah.
But the big thing that he started thinking, well, if I start to box, I'll know how to defend myself and blah, blah, blah. But very quickly, it's impressed upon him that boxers don't fight. You don't do that.
Yeah.
But psychologically, he comes around to realizing that you don't do that. That's not a way. Like it's a lot more subtle. It's a lot more subtle than Fight Club in terms of, you know, men fight and we have to fight and get the aggression out, and that's what and they do fight, right? It's Fight Club. They do fight. They beat the shit out of each other. Whereas this guy becomes a professional boxer and it becomes an economic way. out of his
It's still
life.
Not a very positive story around boxing. Because it's not saying, look, rather than go out in the street and belt the shit out of people, channel it into a sport like boxing.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's not saying that either, because he does channel it into a sport like boxing, and that doesn't end up so well for
him. No, because I think it's very honest about the risks and perils associated with boxing. I mean, it is a sport where people beat the shit out of each other, albeit with padding and gloves, but still, I mean, you know, you're not sitting down making doilies. There is permanent physical risk.
It's definitely short on doily making.
Right. So, but I quite liked it. I quite liked that shift in the character.
It didn't grab me as the other four did.
Yeah, I don't think it grabbed me any less.
Okay.
I think Warlord was the one that grabbed me the least.
No, see, that resonated with me because I do have...
Because you're losing it.
Yeah. Not that I have no issue with my... Anyway. So,
anyway.
But...
See, sensitive topic.
Yes.
No, but I think
what's
that resonated...
next book we're discussing?
I think it resonated least with me because it was... I think it was the most simple... It was a comeuppance story. Okay. Here's this horrible person and... He's going to marry this woman just because he thinks she could marry, not because he likes her, but because she's okay, he can't do any better. And because of everything that happens in the story, he's the one who ends up getting left on the shelf. And it's like, ha ha, you horrible. I liked it. It was a good story, but I think it was the most simple of the story in the way its mechanics worked. Whereas a lot of the other stories were, it's really hard to pin down the story. Like the story was a lot looser and a lot more open, I think.
No, that's
which
true.
I really, really liked.
That's true.
I liked the neatness of Jaw.
How it all ties in.
How it all ended up tying
it's
in.
A
and
loop
I really didn't pick.
You didn't see it as a loop? From?
No, I didn't. And I think because it's the last story in the book, and by then I'm completely forgetting that this could be any type of spec fic book at all. And then like suddenly like, oh, I see. I really liked it. I really recommend it. It's quick to read. As you said, the style of it is quite not sparse, but
it's not minimalist writing, but
it's very accessible.
It's very readable.
It's very easy to read. And despite the fact that two or three of the stories are the characters you don't like, you don't want to like them, but it does engage empathy. That's interesting. Even the characters you don't like, even the horrible man in Whirl, there's empathy with him. You can relate to
aspects of what he's going
through.
Yeah,
and you do feel a little sorry for him, even though at the same time you're thinking, but you're such a prick.
Yeah.
So it's quite good that way, because often when you get really horrible or narcissistic or, character in a book, you don't like to the point where you don't really empathise with them either.
No, I agree.
And this book doesn't do that. It's quite complicated in its
If I wasn't so focused on reading just new stuff...
you'd go back.
And read other stuff by Asa Nanami, because I think this was really, really good.
It was. I really liked Body. So it wasn't the book I expected, but I'm really glad that I read it.
So you should thank the person who recommended to you, who wrote that article, if they completely don't understand the horror genre.
Well, to be fair, it's been a while. I didn't bookmark it. It could have just been like a list of disturbing fiction. And in my head, I remembered it being a list of horror books. I don't know. But yes.
Was Ghost Summer on the same list?
No. Ghost Summer I heard about. I can't remember where I heard about Ghost Summer. But I've read a couple of Tanana Reeve's books.
Stories?
Stories.
Okay.
Like one of them was actually in that Long Hidden anthology. One of these in Ghost Summer was in the Long Hidden anthology.
Yeah, I'd forgotten it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I feel awful.
No, that's fine.
Is it though?
It came as a surprise then.
No.
You didn't watch it at all?
It made no impact. I mean, I enjoyed the story. Yeah. Saw at the end that it was in Long Hidden. I said, what the fuck? Was that a deleted extra that I...
See, I started reading it and went, oh, this sounds really... familiar. I've read this story, but I couldn't remember the ending.
I remembered one of the other stories, the one where the boy's in the isolation. He's patient zero.
Yep.
I actually remember reading that in FNSF in the year 2000 when it was published.
Yeah. Different stories have different impact on you. So I'd heard about this. It's come out through Prime.
Yes.
And I honestly can't remember where it was either a link on Twitter or just something that came across my radar. And I wanted to read it because I've heard a lot about her work, and this was a short story collection, and I love short stories. I thought, excellent, this is a really good entree into Tanana Reeves' work. And I loved it. It was such a good book.
Isn't it fantastic?
It's phenomenally good. The title story, well, I think it's more a novella. Certainly a novelette, but it might...
It's a novella. It's a novella, yeah. It's 30,000 words at least.
Wow, it's amazing.
It's extraordinary.
It's such a good story.
That's Ghost Summer.
And it just, it winds this, like a present-day story about these... The point of view character, the present-day story, is a young boy whose parents are probably getting a divorce.
Yes.
But he's not meant to know this. It hasn't been announced. His father has just taken him and his younger sister off to his father's parents' place out in the country, which he's really keen to go to because he sees ghosts there, or the children see ghosts there, so he's really keen to go. And so his mother has gone back to Ghana, which is where she came from. Her father's American.
For a funeral, though.
Oh, no, the funeral was when she went back the previous time.
Okay, yeah, you're right. Sorry. They're separating anyway.
So her mother's gone back to Ghana for the summer to spend some time with her family. And the children were given the option of to go with the mother or the father. Not that they were told there was a separation. It was just that mum's going back to visit family in Ghana.
But they would rather go to Gracewood because...
They would rather go to Gracewood.
In their grandfather's house, they see ghosts. Yeah.
So, and then he overhears a conversation while they're at Gracewood about the parents having problems and separating and the children being likely to go live with their mother in Ghana. And he's not happy about that. And that's kind of the setup for the story, but that's the front story of this boy, this young boy who's got this knowledge he's not meant to have for now about his parents. And this sends this kind of fracture through his world because, you know, like it does, he's quite young. He's what, 12?
Yeah, he's 12. Like, and his sister's 8. And there's an older sibling who's in college.
Yes. So the older sister's in college and she wouldn't have to go to Ghana.
But she'd known all what was going
on. And when he finds out that she knew, he feels betrayed again. It's like, why does she know and we don't? And it's all of that is, I guess, the framing of this.
And in the meantime,
story about looking for the ghost.
An old slaver and his farm, the McCormack land.
Yes.
They're digging up bodies.
Well, he's not an old slaver. His family were an old slaving family because this is setting current day.
Correct. So,
so the man himself.
The current iteration of the McCormack lineage is not a correct. Not Yes, because slavery's banned by
but
the
his
state.
His father probably was.
Yes. well, grandfather I think it was. But anyway.
I thought he was already a very
They're
old
digging
man.
Up bodies.
They've found bodies on the land.
And that's actually referred to in the story previous to this.
Yeah, there are all these wonderful linkages.
These two particular, this Ghost Summer and Summer, and then the one before that, The Lake, are all set in Gracewood.
They're all Gracewood stories. Yeah. And then there's another collection which are all Nuyami stories.
Yeah, there's three of those. There's a trilogy of those. Yeah,
so there's a few little arcs through this collection, which are really lovely.
So they're starting to dig up these bodies, which they assume were people who died.
They're not sure who they were, and the reason the bodies are being dug up is because there is a new housing development.
Yes.
Wanting Correct. To be built on that land, and so...
But this wasn't from the slavery period, these bodies. This was in the early 20th century during a riot, essentially.
And that's what we've find out at the end.
Yeah.
Because they're not sure to begin with. Like, there's even some talk that they might be indigenous people's bodies. So they want to stop the construction and work them out, but the construction people obviously don't want to stop anything. And so this is sort of, like, there's so much in this novella that's happening. And the ghosts, like the hauntings that happen in Gracewood and in the house, the grandparents' house that the two children are staying in. It's really, like, I've never quite seen that before. Like, the house gets haunted to begin with by water and oral.
But no one else, the adults don't see it.
No, it's only the children.
Only the children.
And that's explicitly, because the older sister who's away, she said she used to see the ghost. And then it's something like when she turned 15 or something, she said it's almost like a tap got turned off.
Yep.
And she just didn't see them anymore.
And the whole town knows about this, by the way. They all know because it's towards the end of the story and no one doubts Davy.
And the ghosts only come out in the dark.
Because everyone goes, oh, yes, only the kids see the ghosts. Yes. People, this is a known thing within the town. This is not Davy's grandparents are sceptical.
Mm-hmm.
And his father is definitely sceptical. Mm. But that skepticism is soon removed.
Yes.
But not that they actually ever see the father of he
doesn't see
it, but it becomes more evident.
He hears and he feels.
Yes.
And the children get attacked by a ghost dog at some point that leaves permanent lingering wounds. Like the wounds don't disappear when the ghost disappears. The wounds are there, and the boy's hospitalized. So that's kind of the front story, and then the backstory is how the ghost came to be.
So this is a hatred between the Timmons and McCormack family.
Yeah,
so.
And the Timmons are a black family who have their own land.
Correct.
And have a farm, but are deeply resented by the McCormack's family.
And the white community in
general.
And
it's this horrible, like the story within the story is this horrible, tragic thing, and without wanting to give too much of them.
Well, it's a set of circumstances that everyone blames on other things that are not those things. And
yeah, so this thing happens, and the black family blames the white family, or the white farmer.
So the Timmons, Isaiah blames Virgil.
Yep, and thinks that's they did that because racism, and it ended up not being that. And that, like, there was this little, it's funny because reading it, it was like, because the first thing that happens is a barn gets burnt down. And this triggers this a series of events which ends up in the creation of these ghost children, because the Timmons' boys end up dead, and we won't say how. But the Timmons family think that, well, it's the white people, they burnt down the barn and now they've kidnapped our children and all this sort of stuff. And that's not what happened. Like, it was something else happened that wasn't directly the McCormacks or the white people doing something. And in fact, it was the little boys who accidentally burnt the barn down. And I'm reading it going, this is really discomforting, because it's like, but it wasn't racism, blah. But the thing is, it was racism. Because the reason that Timmons thought their barn was burnt down by the McCormacks is the McCormacks have been cheating them and lying them and not paying them
and
encroaching on boundaries and all this sort of stuff. So it's like, okay, this one particular thing wasn't white people being racist and burning down a barn, but that conclusion wasn't erroneous, because this is what has happened through the whole, you know, the history of these people in this town. So it's not it was a wrong conclusion, but it wasn't misconcluded.
Yes, correct.
And that's the tragic circumstances that just seeps through this book.
Yep.
Because if it hadn't been for this climate of racism and these understandable assumptions that have been made, those boys might have been found and not died.
Yeah, that's right.
But you're not, the story.
Oh yeah,
doesn't blame the black people for jumping to conclusions. Oh well, you know, because their conclusions were valid.
Yeah,
they were incorrect, but they were valid conclusions to draw on, and it's just, it's awful. It's like such a deeply, deeply tragic story that doesn't excuse any of the institutional racism that was around at this time and persists in different forms today. It doesn't excuse any of that. It uses, you know, it's quite explicit about it and uses that as this framing device, because it would have been a less interesting story, actually, if the three Timmons children had been kidnapped and killed by the white people. Would have been a less interesting story.
No, I agree. Absolutely.
This is a much more interesting story and a story that has a lot more depth, because it's about, like, that this part of this story is about how racism as a climate, as an environment that you live in, just permeates everything and causes such damage, even if it doesn't cause a specific, you know, directly cause a specific event. It did actually cause that event, just by being the climate that
yeah,
everyone
I mean, you
lives
could
in.
Question, well, why do these kids have to be punished? But that's, I mean, if you want to get all spiritual,
well, you
about
need
this,
to get ghosts from somewhere.
Well, true, but it's such a intense story towards the last third.
It really is,
and then when it all comes together, it's a very blubbing Ian was crying story.
Like it's the ghost story.
Because
the story
because
is
there
the
is
ghost...
a door, because the Timmons family, once the three kids vanish, the parents have another child, a daughter, and she's still alive in her late 90s. She can barely move.
Because the children's vanished. They were never found this story.
And she's always said that they were taken by the McCormicks.
Yeah, she wrote a book about it. That's the belief of a lot of people that this happened.
And there's still this enmity in the town and it's never gone away. And the fact that they've now just found 12 bodies on the McCormack lands only enhanced it and
Bodies that were people that were killed in the riots following this event of the barn burning and the children going missing and both sides.
I mean, we've basically spoiled the story. But
no, I don't think we have. I think there's a lot in this story. And it's just, one of the things I loved about it was that the front story is, so the backstory is about this town coming to some sort of accord in the present because the bodies are found and the front story is about this reconciliation within the family. And it's just a really beautiful story.
It won awards.
I'm not surprised. It's an amazing story. Not that the first two that precede it weren't really, really good. Like this book comes off the blocks at lightning speed. It's such a good book.
Yeah, because the first one, which is The Lake, is about a teacher. Fuck, it's a disturbing story because a teacher who probably was...
A teacher who is a predator.
Yeah, a predator.
Female teacher.
No, not probably. He's a predator. Yeah, no, pretty clearly. Although Tananarive does it so subtly.
She really does.
Really? Because it's done in such cloaked language about how I will get the 16-year-olds to come and fix, because I'm in this old house out in the middle of nowhere. I'll get these 16-year-olds to come and, you know, knock some nails in. But it's a bit more than...
It's the way she said it. The way she says it about teenage boys being so easy to manipulate or something like
that's right. And the lake nearby is you never go in the lake in summer. Basically turns her into a fish.
Well, it turns her into like a predatory aquatic creature.
Yeah.
Not a fish, some kind of siren or selkie.
Selkie, actually, that's probably a lot more.
Except I don't think the intimation is that she wouldn't be able to change back or anything.
Correct.
She becomes this predatory sea creature. It's such a disturbing, creepy story just in the sense of that level, but you add on the whole predatory human teacher level, which mirrors it, and it just makes your skin crawl.
So that's also set in Gracewood. And then the middle story is about also ghosts in Gracewood possessing little babies,
and it's a really interesting story. So the mother in this story has a young toddler who's a handful, would put it very mildly.
Yes,
like the child is, through the mother's eyes, the child is awful and malicious and targets the mother for most of her enmity. She's not, like, there's never anything done about, I don't think the story ever says at any point that the child's evil. She's not like the
child. Oh, no, he's just a little
She's just a really, really problematic child.
She's just a little shit.
Yeah.
That's all. It's not that sort of story where this is
an evil child. And that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm pointing out. This is not an evil child story. It's just a mother.
No, this is a little shit child who gets possessed by a ghost story.
And the child's father, the mother's husband, is in the military, so he's away a lot of the time.
Correct.
So in this particular summer, he's away and she's got to handle her daughter on her own and she's at her wit's end. And then the child becomes possessed by this spirit thing, and no one knows what they are, and the book doesn't, the story doesn't say what they are, they're just this thing, but it makes this child calm and inquisitive and verbal and adoring of the mother. And the story ends like the mother, there's this remedy that the mother's given that is this folk remedy that you give the child this at midnight and the thing will be gone, but she's going, well, but maybe just for the summer. Well, my husband, it's not hurting the child. My child's still in there.
Yeah, because it's made clear that you can do it now or wait 3 months and
summer
goes.
Go away. The thing will just go away on its own.
So and they say, and Billy Boggs' kid would have the same, and he's fine. He's a lawyer now. Exactly. Don't worry about it.
So it doesn't hurt the children, and they go away on its own. But she's like, well, maybe for the summer I can have this gentle, inquisitive, compliant, loving child.
Sort of hint that maybe it does have a lasting effect towards the end, because doesn't she go to a supermarket and the old man McCormack is there, and there's a hint that he may have been possessed or...
Maybe, but I don't think the emphasis on the story is, because again, it would be a less interesting story if the idea was this thing will harm your child if you don't get rid of it, right?
True.
Because if that was the story, then what the mother is thinking of doing, or rather not doing, is unforgivable, right? If she does believe, or there is the risk that this will actually do permanent damage to her child if she leaves the thing there for 3 months.
I mean, I just reread it now. I mean, it's all about being given. It's the last four. I'll read the last. Out of context, it's a bit difficult. But so when it says this old man, it's McCormack. Now, you've got to remember that, again, they're uncovering bodies on his land.
Yes.
Okay? It's his son who's taken over the land, who's in the Leighton next story, but this is the old man.
Yep.
So despite the way Odette gaped at her, Danielle, the mother, wasn't in the mood to pass judgment today. Everyone had something hidden in their past or in their hearts that they wouldn't want dug out. Maybe the McCormack family would have to answer to God for those bodies buried on their land, or maybe they wouldn't. Maybe Danielle would give Lola 6 drops of Uncle June's remedy at midnight tonight, or maybe she wouldn't. She and this old man deserved a little peace, that was all. Just for the summer.
Yes.
Danielle, I love this bit. Danielle rubbed the top of Lola's head, gently massaging her neatly braided scalp. Her tiny visitor in the stroller turned to grin up at her with shining, adoring eyes. If that's not the best sentence.
Yeah. And that's it. So that's, you know.
It's the end of the story. I'm sorry. But.
But as I said, if the question was that her daughter could be permanently damaged.
And I know, I've misread it. It's really about that idea of giving peace.
Yeah. And, but there is no suggestion, I don't think, that this will cause lasting damage. It's just you can, you know, if you want your child back, give this remedy and the thing will be gone. Otherwise, wait 3 months at the end of summer, it will just disappear. And so that's a, and so then the question becomes, well, how forgivable is that? Like, to leave your child wherever your child is now to have this thing which isn't your child but is so much.
There's no evidence it's traumatic.
No, but I mean.
No, I know what you're saying.
Question. It becomes just a much more interesting story. And that, like, what I loved about all of these stories, and I think it pretty much is all of them, that her work, at least in the short form, her work has this openness to it, by which I mean there's a, I think, a purposeful lack of a resolution to a lot of her work. So, for example, with that one, you just read, that's the ending. So she hasn't decided whether or not to give her daughter the remedy. That hasn't happened. She hasn't decided not to. She, you know, it's still, it just sits there. And a lot of these stories, when you get to the end of them, they sit there, but they're not unsatisfying, because they're not actually about a resolution. They're about what a character has.
Like The Knowing.
Which one's
The Knowing is the one where
with the mother,
the mother Rosa, who can
who
tell
just knows
who
when
just knows when people
gonna
are going to die,
and that's it. Just a date, not how, not but.
Well, she knows. She sometimes does know
how.
Yes, she does know because there are people who have tried to avoid and have died on that day anyway. So it varies.
Yeah,
it varies.
Yeah, true.
Because she knows how her brother will die.
That's true. Yeah. So I think maybe sometimes she just doesn't tell people how. She just says the.
But no. With her, this is the big twist. With her son, first off, there's two elements. First off, that Rosa sometimes tells people out of anger. That's how she told. So she'll get really shitty with you, and you never. And the son says, you never know what will set her off.
Yeah.
But she might just blurt her out. Oh, fuck you! You die in 6 years.
You've only got 3 years left anyway.
And that's exactly what she's done with her son, and yet he stays with her. You know, stays with his mum because he knows what's. This is haunting her.
Yeah.
And he does that with the woman that employs her as well. But anyway, there's that. But it's just there's – you think throughout the story when they're talking about time remaining, it's the mum obviously who's her own
– But then you realise, no, it's the narrator of the story who knows.
Who's going to be dead at 15.
At 15, yeah.
But has just come to terms with it.
Yeah.
And the whole story has come to terms with it.
Yeah.
Because this is not a story about him angsting over, I'm going
to
die in 3 years.
And it's not a story about him trying to avoid it or change it.
Caring for his mother.
Yeah.
He knows his mother is sick, and it's about him caring for her and doing whatever he can while he's still around and enjoying life as much as he can based on what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary.
It is. Like, and that's what I mean. All of these stories have an openness to them and a an unwillingness to come to a neat or an expected or an easy conclusion. And I really, really appreciated that. And as I said, not that any of them were frustrating or dissatisfying. They, it was the complete opposite. And I think because they resisted that need to, you know.
Yeah, because the worst part for that story would be if, A, the kid somehow avoided his death, or B, we got to that scene where he dies.
Yeah.
But no, this is a part of their a point in their life 3 years beforehand, and that's what this story is about. Yeah. And it's about the mum in incapacity to cope.
Yeah.
And you're right, and it leaves you, well, what happens next, in a sense, but not like, oh, fuck, what happens next?
Yes, and I think so, like, clearly so much of her incapacity to cope is, I don't think it's so much knowing, I think the mother would have learned to cope and sit with the fact that she knows when people are going to die. And she can't stop this knowledge. It's not like she does anything to know it. She sees someone and she knows when they're going to die. That's it. It's not like she, you know.
And she's been disowned by her living mother, but she was disowned many years ago.
Because she knew when everyone was going to
die. And she told them. Possibly not a good smart move, career limiting move, as I would say.
But I think that's when she was really young and she didn't know. And she just sort of knew this thing and said, and then it started happening, and that's
and
when
she was
got
blamed.
Disowned. Yeah, that's the thing. People kind of blame her as though, and what's the, like the son says, it's a wonderful metaphor because the mother does keep questioning, like, can she stop it? Like, is she causing it to happen? And he says, well, the TV guy just tells you what's on television, doesn't make it appear on television. And I think she would have learnt to cope with her knowledge of these things if one of those bits of knowledge wasn't the fact that her son will die, not only before her, which is hard for any parent, but at 15. I think that it's that bit of knowledge which has absolutely destroyed her. And every day he's there, like every day she's reminded of that. You'd almost think it would have been better if the son had gone away, like for the mother. It would be almost better because she would still know, but like every day he's there, every time she looks at him, she's reminded, you know, and then there must be this clock in her head that's counting down. Oh, it's horrible. Like, it's horrible. It's really horrible. But it's not told from her. Like, that's not the
that's
story.
What, it's told from his perspective. And we're only told late, spoiler, that that's the case. Yeah. But he is such a hopeful character.
It is.
And he's optimistic more than hopeful. It's hopeful's not the right. It's optimistic. He's living it.
He's also just pragmatic.
Yeah, and pragmatic.
Like, he absolutely, and for very good reason, because he's seen it, he absolutely believes his mum. She doesn't know when people are going. He has no reason to not. So he's not sitting there hoping maybe she's wrong. He's not sitting there hoping that he might be the person who, you know. It's just a thing. So he can either spend the rest of his short life trying to avoid it, trying to find a way around it, or just, you know, as you say, just deeply depressed or angry about it. Or he can say, well, this is going to happen as sure as there's going to be a winter next, you know, following next fall.
And each of these stories has this beautiful character work.
Yeah. And there's this, like, a lot of the people, because she gets a job, they move around a lot because obviously she
she keeps telling people when they're going to die.
Yeah.
Shitty with them.
But she gets this little job not telling fortunes, I guess, telling death days. In this little herbalist shop, and she doesn't get a lot of clients, but a lot of people are upset by the news. But there's this one character who seems to be just extremely happy, and the narrator wonders, like, is that because she has a terminal illness and she thought she'd have a lot, because she's dying very soon. She's only dying in like 3 or 4 years or something. And she's a young woman. She's in her 20s. And so, yeah, does she have a terminal illness and she thought she'd die a lot sooner? Or does, and it's like, she's thinking, it's like, if you knew your exact day of death, like, there's a whole, like, there's stuff that you wouldn't do, right?
Yeah, but no.
You know? Like, it opens all these.
I know, just like, yeah.
You know, like, if you knew, for example, which I don't, Ian, but if you knew you were going to die in 18 months.
Yeah.
Would you keep working at Vic Roads? Or would you quit and spend time with your family?
I'd still have to earn money because I have a family.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe you'd.
If I had enough leave and all that,
yeah.
Then yeah, probably.
Right? I mean, there'd be stuff that you'd do now. Like, there is a liberty, actually.
Yeah, which is, you know what? It's always easy to say that. And what this story is pragmatic about is that you can't actually just start running around like a headless.
He still goes to school.
Correct. I mean,
but he finds school really interesting.
That's right. I get that. But that's the point. You can't just drop everything. I mean, he's only young as well. He's 12, so limit to what he could do anyway. But even if he was an adult, this idea that you can just drop everything and just blah is bullshit anyway.
Yeah, but there's decisions you would make differently.
Yes, right? Clearly.
And opportunities you might take.
I don't know. At 42, and I'm very well set in the way I am.
I know there's stuff I wouldn't bother with. Look, you're not going to...
You wouldn't do your doctorate anymore.
Oh.
Oh my God, pause.
That's, if I, 18 months? Well, yes. 18 months, I'm not sure I'd get it finished. So what would be the point of keeping going?
There you go.
What could I do in 18 months instead of finishing a PhD, which I might not get finished?
I'd be very careful in what books I read. I'd be
there you go.
We probably wouldn't do this podcast.
We probably wouldn't do this podcast. But what I mean is, like, there is a certain freedom in having a – that you can absolutely trust. Not a possible – this is not a doctor saying, oh, you've got second-stage cancer, you've got 18 months to 2 years to live, and actually, no, maybe you can live another 10 years or maybe you die in three. Right, this is an absolute certainty. Here's your date. That's it. Unchangeable. Going to happen. You could actually kill yourself sooner. Like, you could voluntarily commit suicide, and that would...
Yes,
it's not will only die.
Yes, there is a point that where someone decides,
I'm not going to die for 50 years. He jumps off a roof, breaks his neck, and dies. So this is like an end point.
You could deliberately
kill yourself if you wanted to beforehand. Like, if you got that stressed about your end point, you could bring it forward. But, I mean, that's it. If you had an absolute day that was firm and irrevocable and you could not live a day past it, there is kind of a – I mean, I imagine – I can't remember his name. I'm terrible with names. But the narrator of this story, like, he still goes to school. Nikki.
Nicholas, I think.
And he says, you know, he finds things to enjoy about school. Like, there's always – he likes learning. There's interesting things. Like, he's also got a freedom in knowing he's never going to have to worry about college. His exams don't mean that much. You know what I mean? Like, he's not going to have to sit the SATs. Get into a college.
Can I just say, we've spoken, five, 6 minutes about this one story?
Yeah.
They're all like this.
Because
the next story.
Such interesting
The
questions.
Next story, which we could spend 3 hours on this book. The next story, Like Daughter, do you remember what that one's about? The ability to clone yourself.
Oh, that is such a disturbing.
How uncomfortable is that story?
But here's the thing. Like, what's interesting about that story, it's not like, I've read quite a few stories about people cloning themselves and the chaos ensuing. I've never quite read one that was the reason for the cloning was that this woman has had, and she's not the narrator of the story.
No. She's had an abusive upbringing.
She's had an awful upbringing.
Yes.
She has an abusive upbringing, an upbringing which was, I don't think extreme poverty, but certainly not very well off. And she's the narrator of the story is her best friend since childhood.
Yep.
And
who's been tasked by her own mother?
Yeah.
Because to keep an eye. So the name of the character who's
Niecy.
Been abused is Denise.
Yeah.
And her and our narrator's mother has said you've got to keep an eye. You've got to protect Niecy.
She's the goddaughter. The narrator is the goddaughter.
But still, you've got to protect her because
when they're children, you mean?
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
You've always
got
to protect her because you know, and that's.
And so they've grown up.
Being her burden,
so
in a sense.
What Denise, the reason Denise has cloned herself as a baby, she's basically given birth to a cloned version of herself. And the reason she's done it is so that she can give herself the life she would have wanted. And it's this, psychologically, it's you completely understand. I mean, it's ridiculous because you're no longer cloning yourself, then your twin is yourself. You know, you're giving birth to a child who is not you and would never be you no matter what. It's not her. She hasn't, you know, rejuvenated her actual self, but this is her reason for doing it, is that she sees that she could give this child all the stuff she didn't have. And it wouldn't be like a lot of parents think, well, my children, I can give them a much better childhood than I had. I can give them a better future than I had. I can give them better chance. It's not, she's not wanting to give her child what she never had. She's wanting to give
herself. Correct. It is literally
what she
herself.
Never had.
This is not figurative at all. This is literally herself.
And this kind of fractures her mind. Well, I think I think she was a little unstable to begin with, but this has been kind of, because her husband can't handle the whole situation.
And that's the thing. She chooses a mate.
Yeah.
But he's not the progenitor of
No, obviously not, because it's
But she chooses someone she feels will provide a good household.
Yes, and be a
and
good
when he
father.
Decides this is too much. Yeah. And he stays around for at least 6 years because the little niece is 6 years old.
Yeah.
He goes, fuck this for a game of cards, and runs off. And that's it, because she realizes I can't provide perfection anymore.
Yeah. And also,
and there's this horrible moment. I just want to say this horrible moment, because they live elsewhere. So our narrator goes on a plane, comes over, and Nisi is saying, the adult is saying, I can't look at her anymore.
Every time I look at her,
I want to vomit.
Yeah.
I want to vomit.
Yeah, she because she doesn't see her daughter as her daughter per se.
Correct.
She sees her daughter as a younger version of herself.
Correct.
And she's repulsed by herself. She's Correct. Got such self-loathing and which has all come from her childhood and her upbringing.
That's a horror story.
It's awful. Like, it's such an awful, awful, but complex and complicated and not simplistic in any way. And as I said, I've never quite seen the cloning thyself from that angle before. It's quite like the do-over, you know.
I've seen do-overs, but not in the way this one's presented.
No.
And also, it's usually from the eyes of the person doing the cloning.
Yes, yeah.
The fact that she's chosen,
or sometimes it's from the point of view of the
clone, has chosen to do it.
Got a lot of pressure on them.
Well, yeah,
for being,
well, correct.
You know,
the fact that she's chosen a third party as the narrator, who's there to protect, you know, whatever, just gives it a whole nother. Because you've also got the commentary here, but not the. There's an element of judging, but it's not judgmental. It is judgmental to an extent, because, I mean, how can you not be as the third party? But you can. But she understands where her best friend is coming from.
And then also at the point in this story, this narrator's been given this choice because she's the goddaughter of the cloned child.
Well, not really a choice, because she knows she can't live.
No, but what I'm saying is she's the goddaughter, right? So she's given this choice to protect her childhood best friend.
Oh, yeah, which she was always told to do,
or to protect
the clone.
The clone, and she can't, and she realised she can't do both. She can't do both. She now has to choose between her best and lifelong friend, who still needs help and protection.
How fucking awesome is this collection?
And it's really good.
I'll be honest, I didn't much like the zombie story, but that's possibly because I've read a few, the one that she wrote with Stephen Barnes. And also because it heads in a direction that I feel it's actually quite an old story.
Yeah, but again, I think it's another quite open story, though.
It ends openly. Like, it actually has a great ending.
Yeah, but I'm still not sure what that. I'm still not sure.
But
I know what I hope.
Until the ending.
Yeah.
It felt a bit by the numbers, as distinct from such the quality that's in the rest of the book. But the ending is fantastic.
Yeah. I think the little trio that are the post-apocalyptic.
The Naima stories?
70-hour flu stories. That little trio, which is, 72-hour flu, which is.
They are fantastic.
Naima, which is, and it's her, so it's the same character in all of them at different stages of her life. And I think they're wonderful. Oh.
The shocking
good.
Aspect of the first one with the grandmother, which I'm not going to say any more about, just that.
Yeah.
And then with the second one, oh, my God, that where she meets a guy. Oh, I don't want to spoil it.
All three of them are
All three have an element as well that is just a gut punch.
Yeah. But not in an over-the-top, not in an exploited,
at all.
Really human.
The first one especially could have been exploitative, but it is done so humanely.
Yeah. And it's just like the. As you say, the gut punch is this really awful human dilemma.
Yes.
And it's not over the top, and it's not.
But the fact that in the second story, and again, I'm going to spoil, she gets it totally wrong.
Yeah.
It's just, oh my God.
Really wrong.
And yet, Jew is not willing to, in the third story, to make it so dark that it's pitch black and gives the character something.
Yeah.
At the end. And it's
Now that little trio is quite I can't say they're my favorite little sequence, because the whole damn book is good, but it's quite I'm quite over the kind of most of the post-apocalyptic dystopia.
There's a bunch
stuff.
Of them in this though, and they're all brilliant, except for maybe the zombie one, which I'm not that keen on, but the Naima ones are extraordinary.
And I was thinking about
length.
It, and I think because it reminds it's And I have not yet got around to reading The Parable of the Talents, the second Octavia Butler book. But I think that what I really liked about the Parable of the Sower and why I like the post-apocalyptic stuff in this is it's not over the top. They're all very real, and the dilemmas and things that happen are just they're very real. And in a similar way to, as I said about Body, because the things that happen are not over the top, their gravitas and their importance is not diminished. You don't have to go to an extreme to bring home how horrible such certain situations are. And in fact, sometimes when going to an extreme, you diminish this very ordinary human horror of living in
the second story in particular. That one could have been quite gratuitous because, again, I don't want to spoil it much, but she goes to a rescue center.
That didn't work out.
Didn't work out. So there's going to be lots of bodies.
Yeah.
Okay. But we don't. She knows what's in there.
Yeah.
And we don't need to then be told about all the rot and the decomposition. We get the stench. That's.
Yeah. And, you know, I think I still say if, though something in my head says when we get to a dystopia and a post-apocalyptic world, it's not going to be like the overrun with zombies and the great big, huge, fancy moral dilemma. It's going to be the small stuff which kills us. That's what it's going to be. And it's going to be the everyday dilemmas and everyday horrors, and that's the stuff, you know, the taking care of your cancer-ridden, terminally ill grandmother without running water and sanitation and air conditioning and an ability to get rid of fleas in your house and what that means.
Correct.
Not because your grandmother turns into a zombie and tries to rip your face off. You know, it's the ordinariness of living in that world where the impact is. And I think both Parable of the Sower, which we talked about last year, did that so well. It wasn't over the top in what it was doing. And I think these three little stories and
Parable of the Sower has some of those crazy elements, such as the people getting hooked on the paint thing or whatever and going. Yeah. So it has that. So it's got those sort of Mad Max sort
of bits. Talked about, that wasn't a huge thing. That was almost off to the side.
It was. No, I was going to say, it's not a huge thing.
It was a bit of world building, but it's not something that ever really infiltrated the story we were being told, which was about humans rebuilding community.
Correct.
And to an extent, this is what these three stories that Dew is writing, these three Niami stories, are about, because the first one is about her wanting to hang on to community. And then the second one, she's trying desperately to recover. It didn't work. a community, something she can...
Well, she's trying to repopulate the earth. She thinks
rebuild.
Rebuild.
You know, and the third one... In a way, a bit like Parable of the Sower, the idea that she can go somewhere and rebuild and have a community and do stuff.
As you said, didn't work. Third story, she's now away.
The community has been rebuilt and she's not part of it.
Correct. That's right.
But then, as you say, there's this bit of light that she's given, which after three stories, I thought she deserved a bit of light.
As you can tell probably from my high-pitched voice, I quite like this collection.
I love it. I love it so much.
Because when I get excited, I go, hey, high-pitched, I know. I can't help it. I mean, look, we could talk about, there's Vanishing's the very last story, which is just, it's all metaphor, but it is beautifully written. And the one about the angel of death. Although it's funny,
that was the one I think which least.
No, it's funny.
Like for you, it was the boy with the grandfather and the zombies that you didn't love as much. And I think that was this one. Yeah,
it's funny because Harlan Ellison asked about because it was based on a Harlan Ellison pitch.
Yeah.
What if the unluckiest man in the world met Lady Luck?
Yeah.
She didn't really meet that pitch. It's about the angel of death. I mean, he's unlucky.
It depends what you think is lucky about the angel of death in the situation to which it comes.
The longbow. But
it is a longbow.
I like that, particularly that story. Yeah. But all right, fine, you didn't.
Yeah. I know, I did not like it. No, it was clearly, just for me, one of the less shiny ones. There were so many shiny. it's an outstanding collection, and I'm a bit miffed I haven't read Tanana Reeve Dew before, but...
I just remembered one. The one about the trial.
The trial.
So this girl whose brother...
Oh.
...is possibly going to go on death row.
Oh, yeah.
And it's up to the father to...
completely non-speculative, very realist one.
The father really to go off and put in a character reference because he's well respected, and just the
But again, like, it's not that simple.
No.
Because it's their black family in America. Not, I forget when it's set. It's not. It's early. It's 20th century, but it's not like contemporary, I don't think. But yeah, so he's in this bind where he has to give a character reference for his son at trial, so that hopefully his son, who was just involved in a robbery, won't be executed like other young black men have been, even if they didn't kill anybody. But the community that he's living in and his new wife don't want. Well, he's a businessman, and he's worried. And his wife is worried that this will damage his reputation. Like, it's not a simple story, because it is steeped in the culture and the racism that is in the environment. So this is not a simple choice for him. And he would like to testify on behalf of his son.
It does have
a vague
speculative element in that that she's told the daughter that if she does this ritual,
oh yeah, but I mean,
the father will eventually decide to go, and I know it's thin. It's really about this choice that a father has to make.
I mean, like in one sense, the ritual kind of worked because it made him decide to go and testify. But it made him decide to go and testify because he saw what his daughter was willing to do and how upset she was. So it's one of those things where you're free to assume that the magic that the girl's mother, because she lives with her father and his new wife, the girl's mother believes in
I don't want to make everything about today, the current political situation, but this is a story about how principled you're willing to be when something is on the line and how much you're willing to sacrifice.
Yeah. And I mean, look, it's not a simple decision, because if it does work out the way it's feared, it's not as though he's one man on his own and his son is facing possibly a death row sentence and he has to choose to testify or not, and he will pay the price if that testimony bounces back on him. He's also got other children.
Part of it is that he's trying to hide that he was a philanderer. There's an element of that to it as well. Yeah. Look.
But, you know, there are other people who – and there would be people in the community who rely on him. So it's – as I said, it's not presented – none of these stories present their situations in any black and white form. Like, everything is complex and complicated, and it has ramifications and expands beyond the initial person who the decision or the dilemma is centered on. And this book does that really well, to emphasize that, you know, the networking of human beings and how that what one person does affects another person, even if those two people never meet. And it's a really good book. I can't recommend it highly enough.
I truly adored it.
Yes. So
and I, you know, again, if I wasn't reading, I probably would pick up novels by Tanana Reeve. But anyway, all right, we're going to wrap up at that point, because that was a good ending. That was a good end by you.
Okay, thank you very much.
No problems. So, next month,
yep,
we've got The Core of the Sun by Johanna Sinisalo and Jagannath by Karen Tidbeck.
Which I've been meaning to read for years.
And I was going to read The Core of the Sun this last year, but I never got around to it. And Jagannath I own and I should read. And now I have to read because I've got a podcast to do about it.
You do.
Yes.
In a month.
So, please read those books ahead of time, all right? Like you've read these two books ahead of time, because we only choose good stuff. Well, anyway, please send feedback by commenting at the website, writerandthecritic.podbean.com. Send an email to writerandcritic@gmail.com, or you can follow @writerandcritic on Twitter and sponsor us on Patreon if you feel the urge.
Yes, that would be lovely.
So we will be back next month, back on a monthly schedule.
Hopefully.
Assuming this worked and...
Yes, had some technical difficulties.
The equipment hasn't disintegrated.
So we'll see.
And I have to go home. So with that, bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye. Hello, hello, hello. Da 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 And now we are talking very loud. That's annoying.